How long have you been in the Navy?
Oh, me a bloomin' life.
I'm Jamie Britt.
And I'm Heath Britt.
And together we are E14. We have 40 years of naval service.
And each week we discuss a potpourri of topics, which we like to call smoke pit topics.
These are real world topics that concern us, our marriage, and our Navy with a sailor twist.
So join us each week as we dive into the deep end.
Booyah! So we're on part two with Trish the Dish.
This welcome
everybody
from the bullshit.
Back to E14. Thanks for being on with us, Trish.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, you know, last time we just didn't get enough of your story, and there were some parts that we went over kind of fast, like you being homeless and living in a subway, and we just wanted to really dive into
it. Babe, she didn't live in a subway.
I did. Yeah, I was going to correct her, but it's more fun to have you do it. Yeah. No, I lived in a car when I was like a little kid with my mom. Right. But I mean, I was homeless because of 9/11 and because the subway was blown up when I lived in Chinatown. So yeah, so I've been homeless a couple times.
Quick recap. So just real quick. So you grew up young age. Your mom, at the time she didn't know it, she was bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
Really high highs and dangerous lows.
Oh, big time.
With living with bipolar. You had a grandpa who was in the Korean War, ex-Navy guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived in Joshua Tree, California.
Yeah. And all over. I mean, all three of his kids were born in different states while he was opening up the VA hospitals in the 70s and 60s.
So you used to visit him in Joshua Tree and date all the Marines. Chip was kind of dumb.
Well, when we all ended up in the high desert and he retired to Joshua Tree and I ended up living with him from 12 to 18. Yeah, I was getting golf lessons on the Marine base, and because he had a pretty special entrance to the base. And my best guy friend, who's like my brother, I always call him my brother. He used to golf with me, and he is adamant that we got saluted every time we came on base. And I was like, I don't remember that. And he's like, you had a colonel sticker on your car.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm pretty sure that's not true. He's like, I'm telling you. And I was like, my grandpa was never a colonel. He was the highest you can be in the VFW. But I'm pretty sure he was never a colonel in the, he was in it for like, you know, the obligatory 4 years or whatever it was. And then,
I
don't know. So I don't remember being saluted.
I got the sticker.
Yeah. Maybe he bought it from a colonel or a captain in the Navy.
I mean, my grandpa was a shifty motherfucker. So I'm pretty sure that it's probably, he probably finagled something like, well, because I'm the head guy, the head Pooba or whatever they called it in the VFW or whatever. I mean, he met Bush Senior, I think it was. He has a picture of him and Bush together, ordained by the Pope. I mean, this was like a badass motherfucker. So I wouldn't put that past him.
Right.
But he was also a little loony. So I could see where the generational insanity came from.
We talked about that was your mom's father.
Yeah, exactly.
I just assumed that maybe, until you corrected me, that maybe you got some relief from your mom's bipolar traits when you saw your grandpa, but that wasn't the fact. That wasn't the truth, right?
Wasn't. He ended up having his own special cauldron of insanity, was super into verbal abuse and, you know, tell me I was just like my mother. I'd never amount to anything. And that I was nothing in his eyes unless I made straight A's, even though I was the first female golfer on my golf team in high school, went to California State Finals for track and 2 years in doubles tennis. He never went to any of my track meets, never went to any of my tennis matches. Never went to any of my golf meets, even though he paid for golf and tennis lessons. You would think he'd like to see how that ended up. But yeah, he was
like, I mean, in your day to day as a young one, just hearing that you were not going to amount to anything. I mean, did you take it to heart or did you just whatever, grandpa?
It was It was hard. It was, I mean, I have journals from when I was 13 that were super dark for a 13-year-old to be writing about. And even though I kind of have this little bit of, because I'm still here, y'all, 46 years old, 33 years later, I always had this bit of optimism and just sort of like, my friends were amazing. I always had just amazing humans in my life that helped lift me up and saw a lot in me. And I strived and, you know, but the day to day was really hard and really dark. And I battled depression for so many years. I mean, since I can remember. And even yesterday felt a little slippage into the rabbit hole of depression, but I've learned over the years some really great techniques to sort of allow myself to lean in a little bit and process, like allow myself to take space and time to sit with it and process it. And now today I went on this wonderful hike with my dog and cleaned the house yesterday because movement seems to be really good when you're feeling super, super lethargic and low. Cause I'm still processing a little bit of this, this little relationship I was in for 6 weeks. That was pretty triggering to be really honest, but I don't want to go too deep into that. Cause I don't think it, I don't want that person to think that they have that much power and conversations about that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to honor that.
The worst thing you can do is let somebody live rent free in your head.
True.
That's 100%. I'm always telling people like that, that person is not worth the brain space. So, but you still have to acknowledge that they were in there and that, you know, little things come up and you just kind of go, okay, I can see how that triggered this and this and this. But it also at 46, I can recognize that stuff a lot quicker now than I used to. I used to
Before, we're so proud of you for recognizing that. And
like sees like, though, because y'all have been there too, and y'all have battled insanity and crazy people. So it means a lot coming from you both for sure, because I know you've been there. So cheers.
Cheers. What are you drinking?
I'd love to cheers with water, but
Well, as usual, I've got my Tito's vodka and I'm sharing it with some Trader Joe's sparkling water that's like blueberry lemonade. So y'all are drinking water today?
Yes.
This is a terrible, terrible thing. And I just have to share this with you and everybody. I think I'm starting to become allergic to daiquiris. And right in the heat of Mardi Gras, as Mardi Gras begins, I don't know what it is, but my right eye like starts to swell, and Heath went and got us daiquiris before the show, and my throat started to close up. So I took a Benadryl if I conk out on y'all. But
I'm so sorry to hear that.
What the heck? Old age, man.
Well, I'm drinking jungle juice.
Okay. What's in your jungle juice there, brother?
It's just a daiquiri they make. It's the strongest daiquiri they make. That's what I get. But back to where we were, though, so you said 33 years you've been dealing with this. So you're 13 years old.
Even more, even back to 10, 8 years old, I could remember just having dark, dark thoughts.
Your mom was the start to all of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You lived with her when you were younger. And then dealing with her bipolarism, or however you say it.
Bipolarity.
Bipolarity. Right. Yeah. Dealing with that and not really knowing what you're dealing with. Or knowing, you know, like
not having the vocabulary.
Yeah. And not knowing how she was going to come home at night, and then being homeless as a young person. I mean, were you scared? What was that like?
Well, fortunately, when we were homeless, I was so little that I just barely remember it. So I wasn't even in school yet. So, we spent a lot of time on the Greyhound bus going all around the country. And I just was sort of taking it all in as opposed to processing it, if that makes sense.
As a little kid, I could see all these cool places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I remember watching the little TV. I don't know if you ever took the Greyhound bus when you were a kid in the 70s and 80s, Heath, but they used to have these little table TVs that would like move over into the seat so you could watch your own TV. So I remember watching like the Jeffersons and like, you know, I don't know, those kind of shows in the late 70s. In the Greyhound station waiting for our buses with these little TVs and kind of thinking that was cool. I mean, you know, don't really remember eating, but right. Just sort of drifting, you know, which probably lends itself to why I became such a drifter in my 20s, where I was just living all over the fucking place and just sort of letting life happen at me and not being afraid of that.
Right. And I want to get into that, but I just had a thought. So the whole time your mom is taking you on these Greyhound trips around, and I've been on a Greyhound maybe once in my life. I thought it sucked, but I was older. I was 19 when I took my first Greyhound. So the awesomeness that would happen that you would feel as a little kid at 19, I was like, wow, this is boring. If I was a little kid, I would think it was cool, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, so you weren't going to school this whole time, right?
Because that was before I was five. So, so you 3 years old, we were taking the Greyhound from Texas to St. Louis and back and, right. You know, that kind of shit. And so, there was no school to attend. And so it wasn't actually when I first started school in kindergarten, my mom and my grandma and I ended up in Joshua Tree because what happened was, when my grandparents lived in Sepulveda in kind of around Los Angeles area in the 70s, they built a shack in the middle of the desert and got 5.5 acres for next to nothing for this homesteading act. So like that was that cabin that's later sold for $200,000.
Oh my God.
My grandpa died because he added and added and added when he retired. That was kind of in the family. And so, my mom decided to let my grandma take me, and she took off with some firefighter or something like that. And my aunt and uncle that I'm super close to, Mike and Valerie, they told me years later that my grandma took me to there because I remember going to see them in Van Nuys. And my aunt later told me that my grandma was trying to like, hey, will you take her? And they were like, we're 20 something and we live in a one bedroom apartment and we're just starting our lives. Like we don't have any money. Like we can't afford a kid. That's not, and they never had kids. And I always say I never had parents. They never had kids. So we just kind of adopted one another over the years, but they have a lot of guilt from not being able to take me in those days. And I told them, I was like, if someone dropped a kid off in my life at 46, I don't know that I could take them in. I mean, that's quite an undertaking to just go, yeah, I'll take that kid in and take care of them. Not everyone is financially able to do that kind of shit, but it's really sweet that they always tell me like, we're so sorry we didn't save you. And I was like, you guys have more than made up for it. You know, they've shown me such kindness and unconditional love over the years that I feel like it's why I'm still alive. You know, I know that sounds really heady, but it's so true. So
speaking of your aunt and uncle, I mean, it's not like you're taking in a pet, you're taking in a human life. And that's just the maturity they had at their age to be like, not to think about it, actually put thought into that. And I say, okay, cool. No, yeah, I'll take her.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
we got to save her. Yeah. You know, I mean, reality is you can't always do that shit.
Right. Cause maybe it'd been more harm to take. They didn't know they were young. I can't imagine being that age and taking in.
I can't imagine having that kind of insight in my 20s.
We just got a new dog and that dog's driving me crazy. I can't imagine.
Yeah. <It's> 100%.
Yeah.
But so later in life, so they say this, bipolar, whatever, it's hereditary. Did you feel that growing up? Did you feel you might have maybe caught, but she didn't know she had it until recently. Well, I don't know how old your mom is, but
it was about 10 years ago.
Okay.
When she finally told me, when she was finally diagnosed and shared it with me, when we were kind of on speaking terms. Well, we've since haven't spoken. I mean, she just kind of disappears. Well, we all saw each other when my grandpa died. But it was fucking weird, but it was so much easier for me to have this compassion for her and also distance instead of like, oh, I'm going to have a relationship with her because she's here. You know what I mean? Like, it's my mom. I better have a relationship. I've never felt inclined because I did a lot of therapy and self-help over the years that is like, it's okay to not have a relationship with toxic people, including those who made you.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, so back to your question though, I definitely, never thought I was bipolar. And I've never thought I was borderline. I didn't think I had those kind of personality traits, but the propensity toward depression, was super large. And in my 20s, after I lived in France for the second time, I lived in Paris, London, and New York and within a year, and then moved to Springfield, Illinois, just to fucking catch my breath, make some money, you know, and be with some friends from college. The longer I stayed in Springfield and the farther away from my dream of traveling the world, and having a degree and making fucking coffee or sandwiches for low pay, even though I was in a cool punk band, I mean, I slipped into the darkest that I've ever been in my life and really struggled to get out of bed and really struggled. And actually right towards the end of living in New York, there was a point where, something happened in terms of like this coffee house I was working for. Just, it's a long story, but it just really shook me. And then of course, 9/11 happened right before that. And I was just, I remember having such a hard time brushing my teeth and I was like playing Minesweeper like nonstop, like, you know, you're depressed when you're fucking playing Minesweeper. But then when I was in Illinois, my friend was like, you know, you could try an antidepressant, you know, and I was like, man, I don't want to take any kind of psychotropic because I don't want to lose who I am. You know, I think a lot of artists feel that way too, where it's like you put all that energy into your art and, you know, and you feel your feelings on stage or through whatever medium you're using. And if you take Paxil or something, I know I finally ended up going on it for about 3 months, but I was so far away from myself. Like I felt like I was way, right, way out here. And I was, you know, like I was,
yeah,
being a person out here, but I was way back here watching it all. And, but then I fell into a deep depression in Portland, you know, almost a decade, well, about 5 years later. Yeah. About a decade later, and was watching nothing but Everybody Loves Raymond. And I have a friend that's always like, hey, on a scale of like Everybody Loves Raymond to like Paxil, where are you? And I'm like, oh God, that's going to be our meter from now on. It's so funny. Cause yeah, it's pretty depressing to watch that show, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why he thinks that, but it's so funny.
For many years, The Office, just The Office straight since 2009, I would watch it every single night because it was what was comfortable to me. And
oh, that's why I watch Frasier every night. I have to watch Frasier to go to sleep.
We do that with The Office and a new show. It's off now, but it's newer than Office, Superstore.
Yeah.
It's on.
Oh, I never got into Superstore. But yeah, that's that really just basic humor that's not too political and not too violent and not, you know,
right,
just kind of like Friends. I liked Friends when that was on Netflix for a while.
Shows, I guess, where you don't have to think about anything. You can just sit there.
Passive. Just be passive. That laugh track in the back, there's something about that that helps, which is, you know, they don't have that in The Office, but I don't know. There's something about that laugh. But like as a 70s, 80s kid, there's something like nostalgic and comforting, which is ironic, right? You wouldn't think that anything from my childhood would give me comfort, but having been raised by a television rather than a human. Yeah,
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I learned all my life lessons from Silver Spoons and Family Ties. Right.
Definitely. So you said you were living with your grandparents. They tried to get your aunt and uncle to take you. They couldn't at the time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So you were going through school. where your parent, where they lived in, your grandparents lived in Joshua Tree. You said,
so yeah. So I'll get back to that. So when my grandma tried to take me to Southern California to have my, my aunt and uncle take me, she just decided when they said no to take me, at the time they were living in Temple, Texas.
Okay.
And right next to the VA hospital there, actually, you could see it from our, from the backyard. So I lived with them for, from kindergarten for a year. And then, and it was actually a pretty great year. So the insanity of my grandfather didn't rear its ugly head until it was just me and him in the house.
Right.
When I was 12 and my grandma had a stroke, had to go into a nursing home because she had multiple sclerosis. It's a whole thing. It just got really ugly as I was becoming a teenage girl. I mean, shout out to any parent of a teenage girl, let alone a teenage girl who, you know, only has a grandpa and there's no woman and, you know, to explain what's going on with the hormones or right. just the, you know, being bullied at school, you know, having all the things. So it was, he was my best friend for a long time. Like, you know, when I lived with them in kindergarten, I have a lot of really amazing positive thoughts about him. And, but I do remember the screaming, like my grandpa and grandma would scream fight with each other. And I moved back into that at 12, all the years later, and was like, oh boy, like, yeah. I mean, it was bad. And he'd hit her knee. I don't know if you know much about MS, but you get shakes.
Yeah.
So her leg would start shaking. He'd be like, God damn it, Betty. And like beat her leg to stop it from shaking. And, you know, you're just sitting there watching all that and just being like, ah, this is so terrible. Like, this isn't the way life should be. And again, I can't stress this enough. I was exposed to, or maybe gravitated toward, really healthy families when I was growing up. Like, people were kind and they were loving to each other and they didn't raise their voices. And, you know, people got grounded and shit. But
that's not something that you even know what that looked like, because being raised outside of that, you know, most people don't even know where to find, or that anything is other than normal with this
dude. Silver spoons and family ties, though. Wow. I know it was fake, but I saw what, you know, happy families looked like, mm-hmm. and just sort of found that in my friendships.
Right.
You know, like, who's the most normal kid in school? And I would go be friends with them. Right.
And, you know, it's not like family ties and silver spoons didn't have issues, but it all could be solved within the 30 minutes.
Right. And like a lot of times, if there was fighting, they would always pan to the parents discussing about, okay, how do we deal with this? And there, and so the beauty of the, you know, 80s sitcom is the amount of analyzing communication with other humans. It's a very, I know it sounds really like way more credit than I'm giving them, but I spent a lot of fucking time watching TV and I thought about that. And I thought about how, you know, why are you in trouble? Why are you being a dick kid if you're doing something wrong? And, you know, and they would go through that, you know, they would go through the sort of life lessons through these sort of like dialogues with parents and each other. And, you know, and I listened, I heard that. I don't know. It sounds so cheesy to say it out loud, but
it makes sense though. When you're grasping at something to hold on to that makes you feel good and not feel like shit, like you were made to feel for shit your whole
yes.
life. At least yes. your childhood life.
And yeah.
You're looking for something to make you feel good. Like you're almost like you were with them as you're watching it.
Living vicariously. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's the beauty of television, which is what I, you know, I really kind of feel sorry for kids that have been coming up since reality TV, because, you know, I mean, the Kardashians are super bland and basic. So I guess there's nothing really wrong with that. But when you look at how ugly people treat each other in reality TV, like at The Bachelor and stuff like that, and the conniving and the disrespect and the fighting. I wonder how much people see that are kids that are coming from super abusive homes, because there's no positivity. There's like, what are you going to watch? I wonder, like, there should be a study, you know, what do you watch as a kid when you're in an abusive home that brings you positivity when we're inundated with so much violence and negativity? And I know I sound like an old person saying that, but fuck, The Bachelor is a super violent show in a lot of ways, just in the way people treat each other.
Ethan and I were talking about it because the new Fresh Prince of Bel-Air series is coming out, and it's so much darker than the original. The original is lighthearted and comedy. Yeah.
And another show that I gravitated, that and The Cosby Show, just loved the beauty of the kindness.
This, what they would call modern day, or if it happened in modern day, it's so much darker. It's just,
well, shit, look at Riverdale. The Archie comics were one of my favorite comic books to read as a kid. I watched a couple episodes of Riverdale and was like, fuck this. this shit's darker than The Walking Dead.
Yeah. Right. I tell you what, growing up, I remember when the first reality show came out, Real World, right? The MTV, like the original.
Yep. Puck.
Yeah.
I was there. I watched it.
Yeah, me too. But I remember going from like thinking that everybody is just out to help people to thinking that came out. I was like, everybody's got ulterior motives. Nobody does anything. And that went in my head. Like, that actually made me more. Actually, it's true to a lot of people. A lot of people do have ulterior motives, but I never even thought of that. Watching, like you said, Family Ties, Silver Spoons, everybody's just wholesome, right? Everybody's out to, if they're going to do something for you, it's because they want to help you, not because they're thinking about what they can get on the.
Right. I mean, you'd have those bad characters, but they always kind of put the spotlight like that was a bad character.
You. There was no guessing. Here, Real World came out. I was like, wow, I like this guy, but he's kind of a jackass.
Right.
He's kind of a piece of shit. And then it just got bigger when they started, you know, making all the Survivor and
the Osbournes and
Osbournes.
Oh my God.
It was kind of blew up and they were entertained. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, fuck yeah. Way more entertaining than Family Ties. Come on now.
Right. I mean, but we're so used to it now. We're so used to the dark. We're so used to the controversy and, you know, the
drama and Real Housewives.
The Jerry Springer type that, you know, we watched a documentary on how his talk show was, you know, so trashy and everything, and how he got so big and how it changed the talk show industry from, like, you know, that lady with the red glasses. What was it?
Sally Jesse Raphael.
Now everybody's fighting on these talk shows, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's really sad. Like, I was watching Dr. Phil the other day. and I remember thinking, like, wow, we're so far away from Oprah and Donahue. Like,
yeah.
And the, you know, I'll watch The View every once in a while, but Whoopi hasn't been on it lately because she's doing some stuff for Picard, which is pretty exciting. I can't wait to see her.
I thought she got in trouble.
Well, she did. Oh yeah, she did. I forgot. I was watching during the time when she was doing filming for Star Trek, but you're right. Then she came in and did that whole,
but I couldn't remember what it
was. It wasn't a racial thing, but then got put on probation, which is. And that's a whole other podcast we could go into,
got her hand slapped though.
Yeah. But like, it's very interesting how, you know, even with The View, you know, there's a lot of kindness on that show. Like, those women really do try to see each other and hear each other, but, it gets ugly. It gets dark.
Well, I feel like with The View, I think it started out as a good thing. Don't get me wrong. But I feel like if you don't believe what they believe, they're going to trash you and make you feel like a big piece of crap. I've noticed
that. Yeah. What was that? John McCain's daughter was on it for several seasons and she ended up leaving. And I remember thinking, like, I didn't like a lot of things she said, but I really respected that she was a voice of, you know, some things. And actually, if you listen to her, she had some pretty good points. I mean, she's John McCain's daughter. And then so when she left, I've noticed now that it really is a one mind group of women, which is kind of sad in a lot of ways, but I don't know. It's also really hard because we don't know how to have, and we've talked about that, the three of us, we can't have opposing views anymore and be loving and kind. We have to be like, no, you don't fucking believe in vaccinations. What the fuck? right, you know, and right. It's like, okay, like that's going to get us anywhere in this world. So,
right. No, 100%. Cause you know, when you start doing that, then you're just automatically isolating the other person and vice versa. I don't like right-wing nut jobs all in one either. Cause everybody has an agenda.
Extremists in any way.
Yeah, it's bad.
It's so bad. It's so bad. And yeah, so I wonder, you know, if I was in the situation I was in as a kid nowadays, I mean, there's so little goodness and sort of nonviolent joy to watch on TV in the world. And, you know, even Rick and Morty, I started watching because I've been smoking more weed lately and it's been nice. And I was like, well, I better watch some Rick and Morty because, you know, I'm being a stoner. And I actually got a lot of anxiety watching that show because there was so much violence, even though it's very intelligent. Like there's a lot of really good shit in that.
Right.
But it's loud. There's lots of, you know, harsh lines that are drawn, the colors, and there's nothing relaxing about watching Rick and Morty. Like you better strap the fuck in because you're about ready to go for a fucking ride for 30 minutes.
Don't drop a hit of acid before you watch Rick.
Oh my God. Like you're holding onto your seat, you know. I haven't actually watched it since I binged it pretty hard like last weekend and was like, okay, I think I'm good. Like I need something. So I've been watching Columbo. I like watching Columbo a lot. And it just
right. So funny that you go back to those old
Columbo's
shows,
old show know? Too. It's been around 70s, right?
Oh man, yeah. I fucking love it's just so good. There's, you know, yeah, I know it's based on violence, but I like Sarah Silverman. I listen to her podcast a lot and she says that and Law and Order are like softcore murder shows.
Yeah,
softcore. And I'm like, fuck yeah, that's so softcore. Cause they don't glorify the violence. No. It's all about solving the story and the character development.
Catching the guy gal that's doing wrong. It's not, they're not glorifying, they're trying to put him away. My mom was a big Law and Order person. I used to watch it with her a lot. And
dude, the OG Law and Order was so fucking good.
It was very
so good. But
loved it. So what? I know you have a master's degree. Am I wrong?
Is that, I do. I almost have a doctorate too.
What pushed you? Because I'm thinking of Jamie. Jamie has a master's degree, but she was always pushed to do well in school. She had great parents in my personal opinion. And she was pushed. So it was always in her mind. You didn't have that. You were, I mean, your mom was bipolar, was a wanderer, like you said. Your grandpa basically told you you're a big piece of shit, lack of better words.
Yep.
What drove you? Because a kid just will say, I'm going to get a doctorate today.
Yeah. No, I love that question. Because school was the only place I was safe. Yeah. School was where I was told I was a great writer. I was a good speller. I was the smartest kid in the class. I mean, I do have ADHD. I was diagnosed with, in the 70s, they called it hyperactive disorder. And you just, the whole thing was just don't give her sugar. I missed that whole, about folks that are about 5 years younger than me. Got to have the, extended time to take tests. And there was a lot more compassion for hyperactive disorder and attention deficit disorder. And so it was really hard, in a lot of ways too, because teachers didn't really know what to do with me. Cause I'd finish my whole, you know, my work first and be like, what are you doing? You know, bother everyone in class, you know? But I always tested off the charts, with the standardized testing that, you know, the obligatory test you have to do, as a kid every year. And so, you know, I'm so lucky that I was always in good enough school districts to where in the 80s, the teachers recognized that even though I had a real big problem with talking, that I was super smart. And so I was, you know, I got to go into these like independent study groups where we learned to program computers like Apple IIe and, you know, And I was encouraged to write a speech for, you know, Rotary Club. I was encouraged to, paint and won awards for art and spelling bees. And so I could, you know, and I remember specifically when I lived in Illinois as a little kid for a couple years, I remember, you know, my mom was really abusive. And I think I mentioned this before, where it'd be like 5 hour abuse sessions where she'd just pummel me for 5 hours straight, dragging me around the, you know, I'm sorry if this is too much for people, but I'm pretty far removed at this point. So I can just say this stuff and it's not like, doesn't really do anything for me, but trigger warning.
You had to live it. So
I had to live it and process it for all these years. So it's pretty easy for me to kind of go into the gory detail, but I would then wake up in the morning and I would feel super suicidal. And I'm 10 years old at this point, and walk into school and thinking, you know, I'm not going to talk to anyone and I just want to disappear. And then the minute I would hit that playground, because I always went to school a little early to play on the playground before school, and I'd see my friends, and just there was something so, I would, like I said, I'm so lucky that I was in schools where, even though I was bullied, I still found like a space to feel good. That really, I remember thinking like, I'm going to travel the world and I'm going to get a degree and I'm going to college. And I remember when I graduated from undergrad, I remember thinking, well, fuck, I don't know what else to do now, because I made that goal happen. Now what do I do? But you know, oops. And it was never like, I'll show them. It was more just like, I could see at a really young age that there was more to the world than the abuse I was living in. And even though I held it and I felt it and I was super wanting to kill myself, and that little thought comes and rears its ugly head still to this day. But I don't take it that serious. I just kind of think about it and process it and then go, all right, well, I'm done thinking about that.
You know, right, day. I'm over it. I don't care about life. Right.
Yeah. I just think about, you know, back in the '80s and the playground and all of this stuff. And then I think about the kids today and I'm thinking like, do they have that kind of experience in school in an antisocial world? It's funny how social media brought everyone into this antisocial.
I can't imagine. I mean, and cause when I was a counselor at these couple pretty terrible poverty stricken schools, in good districts. So they cared. So they hired someone like me to come in and do some like, serious, conflict resolution. I remember I had to work with these third grade girls, because they were, bullying each other on Instagram. And I remember thinking like, I don't know, again, I don't know how I would have survived in today's world with my child. Like I know this sounds super dark, y'all, but I understand why there's so much suicide now, because I don't see a lot of joy in the world being modeled anywhere. I don't see it modeled on, you know, you have, unless you know how to create your own algorithms in social media, you see the ugly so much. Yeah. And, you know, it's really a dangerous thing, these algorithms. So like YouTube and all that.
Life being lived. I see a lot of filters. I see a lot of like, oh, there's a cool car. I'm going to go pose next to it, but I couldn't even afford that car. You know, I see a lot of like fake made up lives, and that in and of itself is making people all weird in the head. You know,
it's funny. We were talking about this because I watched, Inventing, the Anna Delvey story on Netflix. The girl that plays Ruth in Ozark, in the Ozarks.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so good. But it spun me a little, because so basically, in a nutshell, it's the story of this girl from, you know, she's part Russian that moved to Germany to America, and basically schemed her way into like being a sort of socialite. and scammed all these banks and people and was living this fake life. And she's now in prison. And I binged the hell out of that, but it triggered something in me that put me into a pretty dark depression afterward where, and I know, like I said, I think a lot of it is just having the space and time to sort of process the last 6 weeks of this relationship I was in and just some stuff that was going on in work. And I was just kind of, I think it's really, it seems like we hear more and more about people living those kind of lives and wanting those kind of lives because that's what they see as success rather than, you know, giving back to the community. And like, ain't nobody want to see a story about that. You know, like nobody wants to hear about this girl who devoted her life to the local food bank, you know, like boring. 14.
Boring. I don't want to hear that. Yeah. These terms now in 1980, that might've been exciting.
100%. Look at reading fucking Rainbow and Mr. Rogers. Like right. We were watching beautiful kindness again and again being modeled.
Right.
Like just being modeled over and over again. And I just don't see that. Like I know, you know, I try to watch whatever, you know, new stuff. I fucking love the Ozarks. It's great shit.
Yes.
A lot, but it's super dark. But you know, when it comes down to like just a sweet basic show of like people just being sweet and basic, it just doesn't, I don't know where it is. I don't, that's why I gravitate to like fucking Columbo and shit. Cause it's like, even Columbo was giving kindness to the killers.
Right.
You know,
and
I was a little manipulative, I guess, but
I was watching this show and it seems not relevant, but it is. So I was watching Joe Montana, in my opinion, one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game.
I think a lot of people would say that. I even know who he is.
Yeah. And you even watch sports, you know who Joe Montana is, right? But he was part of our childhood, right? He was winning all those Super Bowls.
Big time.
I remember watching his documentary. It's a 5 or 6 part documentary. I finally finished it last night. But just the way the people, it showed like his games and, you know, it showed highlights and they narrated how he pulled himself out of this hole. But the people, the fans, it was so wholesome.
Mm.
Just the way people were back then. And you forget how it was, even though I lived it. But it's been so jacked up for the last so long, 30 years or so. It's been so jacked up that you forget how people were back then.
You know, were they though? You know, that's the thing. I had a conversation with my uncle about this. You know, he's like, I don't remember people being depressed and, you know, having all these mental issues when I was younger. And I was like, but it's because we weren't allowed to talk about it.
Maybe so.
Of course you didn't know anything about what I was going through as a kid because there wasn't a venue. There weren't vocabulary words for it. Like we know what anxiety is. We know what PTSD is. We know what depression is. We didn't talk about that shit back then.
Right. Look at homosexuality. Oh, mm-hmm. Homosexuality has been around forever. It's just people didn't talk about it back then.
Rock
Hudson.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, what do you call it? He was like a pinup model for women. You know, he's a dude.
Ladies
that was,
man.
Ladies
right.
Man.
And he was the first person we ever heard of dying of AIDS. And then you had the leads, you know, Freddie Mercury and like, if it wasn't for those two guys, bless their hearts, like, I don't know that we would have these conversations today the way that we do. I mean, it took celebrities that people loved dying of this disease for it to like get any momentum, even though everyday people were dying
right
left and right. I don't know. It's a catch 22, right? Part of me is like, I don't know how I could have made it. Of course, I can see why there's no more suicide, even though there's a lot more dialogue. There's a lot more help. There's a lot more of a spotlight on it. It's hard to tell, you know, if it really was any better. I just think that it was just that we had a lot more. And maybe it was false. You know, like I said, the sitcom isn't real. It's not fucking real when Ricky Schroeder and his dad hash it out in 30 minutes, like with love and joy. Right. But But at least it was something that you could escape to. I don't know. Even the video games were fucking sweet, like Frog Bog. It was a fucking frog jumping off his lily pad, catching flies. I played that game fucking for hours every day.
Tetris or Mario Brothers.
Oh, Dr. Mario. I mean, there's nothing violent about any of that shit.
Right.
And I lived inside those video games. And then I remember when I stopped playing video games because it stopped being sweet and fun. It was fucking Doom and, you know, 007. Everyone's, you know, it's all about shooting. And I don't give a fuck about shooting stuff. I wanted to like become big and roll down hills.
I want to catch a fly. Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
What they say, and I know we're getting ready to close out, but they say everybody has two wolves inside of them. Whichever one you feed is the one that gets bigger, and that one is the one that shows out. Yeah. And that's what we're, as a society, are feeding, is the dark and the doom and gloom. So yeah, it's just going to continue to get bigger, and we're going to lose that other little wolf inside of us that's kind and wholesome.
But see, that's why podcasts like yours and dare I say mine are so important, because, you know, I love podcasts because I think that it's the last great frontier of kindness, because it's a place where people can share these stories. And here I am at 46. I didn't off myself. I kept going. I find new reasons every day just to get out of bed and to recognize the pain and suffering and not fall prey to it. And yeah, so, you know, we got to keep doing that. We got to keep feeding the good wolf. Right. I love that. That's such never a heard beautiful of that.
I love euphemism. Definitely. I have a couple questions for you before we wrap up.
Okay.
So what
rapid
was
rapid fire?
Yeah, not rapid fire. I'm going to do that.
So you that's can think
about it. Yes, Gen X thing.
That's Gen X voice.
Not the thunder. But who was the first person to say, Trish, I'm proud of you? That's in your family.
That's in my family?
Yeah. And how old were you?
Oh, okay. In my family, it would be, it'd be my aunt and uncle. And I can't remember who said it first. But I think I was about 25, 26. So really in the depth of my depression, in that first real, well, I guess it would be the second real big darkness. And my uncle was like, I'm so proud of you. And I always tell people, I guess it was my uncle, like, I always tell people how proud I am of you, that where you came from and who you are. And I remember I would just get off the phone with him and cry, because I sure didn't feel like I was amounting anything. I feel like I really was, you know, I was living in an apartment without heat, and it was like, you know, middle of winter in the Midwest. You can't really live that way.
Like in the South without air conditioner in the summertime, you can't do it.
100%. Yeah. So yeah, I would say I was about 25 before I heard a family member say they were proud of me.
That's a long time.
That's a long fucking time.
Yeah. Wow. You had a degree by then, and you had a degree. I don't know if you had done.
I was only the second person behind my grandpa ever to get a degree in my family.
Wow. Okay. When did you look at yourself or think of yourself and said, Trish, I'm proud of you?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think that I had moments of success where I was like, oh, that's fucking cool that happened. But I don't know. I don't know. I know that in the last 4 years, I say it to myself almost every day. It's a mantra. I tell myself that I'm beautiful, that I love myself, and that I'm proud of myself, almost on the daily. But I don't remember, I mean, cause there was a long period of time I couldn't look at myself in the mirror, because I just saw the kid that was abused that my mom would drag to the mirror and tell me, look how ugly you are. Well, yeah, everyone looks ugly after 5 years of getting their shit beat out of them. Yeah. You know, you're all puffy and bruised and bleeding
and you're
crying. And, you know, but I don't remember as a kid you know, being like, I'm proud of you, Trish, you know, but definitely in the last 4 years, it's been a mantra to tell myself, you know, loving words.
You should do it every day because I can speak for Jamie. I speak for myself after knowing your story and what the hell you've been through. We're proud of you.
Oh, thank you guys.
Telling your story, and you wake up every morning and you help educate young people.
Well, I don't know if I educate anymore. I'm not a teacher anymore, but I do try to lead my student workers in a loving, kind way. So,
which is a form of education. So yeah. Definitely.
Good point.
So thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking me too.
You're an amazing person, and you have a great podcast. And please, before we leave, shameless plug for the Jen.
I will. Thank you. I've been on a little bit of a breather, a little break. I took a mid-season break for the last couple months, but I'm looking to start again in March. But you can find me at, anywhere at Gen X Voice. I'm mostly active on Instagram and, although I'm on all the other platforms and, I'm at GenXVoice.com. And if any of your listeners want to come and share their story with me, and how their childhood, cultivated who they are, I'd love to hear your stories. So you can reach out to me at GenXVoice.com. I interview people that aren't just born in, 1965 to 1980. I like having all generations come and talk, but I do have a little bit of a Gen X voice slant, because, hey, it's my podcast.
How you want.
But, and I've had both of you on and I can't wait. Your guys' episode will be one of the first one that airs in March. So stay tuned, everyone, because I love having them on together. I don't want this to be over. Like, I love having, like, we've been talking to each other like every other week, it seems like, for the last month or so. And it's been wonderful.
Since December.
Yeah. You guys are super amazing. And I just love you too. And you're doing such good stuff, guys. And I love this series you're doing.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And we're going to close out, but hang on a sec, please.
Boom. You got it.
With that, we wish you
fair winds
and following seas.